This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh boy, it's going to be 80 degrees here. I'm so happy. I don't like the cold weather. My brother came down from Upper Michigan and the Upper Peninsula, and we're youpers. And so he came down. The day he left, he had 36 inches of snow at his front door, and he was happy. He came down, and it was cold for us. It was. We had 65 degrees for a few days there, and he thought it was really hot. But he enjoyed it, and it was just a lovely time to have him and his wife, Debbie. They were here. They brought the wonderful thing about my brother, he drives an F-150. It's a big old Ford, and he has the whole back filled with coolers. And so he brought down food. He brought down so much food. It was quite amazing. And it's just filled my freezer, and I'm so thrilled, especially fish, because, of course, I love Lake Superior fish. And so he brought all of this down and all sorts of other wonderful foods, and I really want to thank them. And they are headed north today, and so I hope they're listening to me, because I just want to thank them so much for coming down here and giving us an absolute wonderful week of just plain having fun with them. It's always so good to see them. Now, you know, one of the things I like to do on this program is to promote books that have been out for a while. That's why we have Rita Moreau, who does book buzzes, and little promos that help us remember different authors and their books. But today I want to play one of my favorite interviews. And this is with Amor Towles, the author of A Gentleman in Moscow. Now, the reason I want to play it is they're working on the movie. And I would love for all of you to read it before the movie comes out. Because I want it in your head. I want you to see it first. When they first announced that they were doing the movie, they said Kevin Branagh bought it. And I was so afraid that he was going to star in it, because he is not a gentleman in Moscow. But I don't know who they're going to select. I don't know. They should be probably in production, and I expect it's going to come out sometime this year. But I want you to really read this book. And to all you authors out there, you have to read well. You have to take that time, that effort, to make sure that every once in a while you just stop everything you're doing and read well. Read books that are so well written that you learn from them. And of course, this book, A Gentleman in Moscow, is one of the best books in the past 5 years. So you'd just love to read it. It will be really fantastic. And, you know, the nice thing about reading is you learn so much. And also, I love the audible version of a book, particularly if you've read the book and then you have the audible version. Then you know, it really opens your eyes, and you can start seeing how the words work together. And so I would really love to recommend that you read this. I'm going to play this interview and listen to it. And then I also have Ed. Do I have somebody on? No, it's just okay. I might get a call later on, but if so, we'll have it after we listen to this interview. Because what's wonderful about this interview, I also invited the narrator. So many people, narrators are so, they just don't get the intense gratitude that they deserve, because when they do a really great book like this one, I think maybe there were like 100,000 downloads just of the Audible version. because the narrator is one of my favorite people, and you will hear he's going to read some of the book. But here's the beginning of the interview, and we'll go right through to the narrator, and just listen to this, because this is Amor Towles. Amor, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Patsy. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Well, you know, I have to channel my inner Count Rostov today, because it's been one of those mornings. I ran out of petrol on my way here, and it's just been one thing after another. And so that's why I need this book in my life. It is a calming book. And, you know, I wanted to tell you, you know, last time I spoke to you, that I, when I finished your book, I put you on my, I have a big bookcase full of Russian books. And I tucked you away between Tolstoy and Chekhov. You know, it was nice and snug in there because my shelves are really full. And then you stayed there about a week. And then I pulled the book out and I had to read it again. And it's never gone back because it never leaves the side of my favorite reading chair.
Thanks very much.
It is so amazing. I think that for the people, for my listeners and for my friends who have read the book, we no longer call it A Gentleman in Moscow. We just say it, the book. The book. I mean, that's all we need to say. Did you see it in the book? We read it in the book. Oh, do you remember that part in the book about the bees? Do you remember that book, that part in the book about the bouillabaisse? So, you know, it's just, that's it. We just, once you read this book, it's the book. What can I say? You know, I can't do the whole program just telling you how brilliant you are, although...
Oh, yeah, please don't.
you know, but, and on the other hand, I was thinking, you know, there are so many things that I'd like to know, but in a way, it's like, your book is like this beautiful big sausage, you know, like this wonderful summer sausage that you can get once in a while that's just when it's perfect. And I don't want to know all the things that went into it. You know, I want it to, it's so perfect. I almost don't want to dissect it. And I imagine all of these PhD students who are at some point in their lives going to be, you know, dissecting this book and saying, how do you write this? How do you write that? How do you, you know? So do you think about that, or what PhD students are going to be doing?
No, I don't think too much about PhD students. But certainly As an artist, as a writer, I'm interested in creating a book that is rich enough, multi-layered enough, that it rewards a second reading, that it rewards closer consideration, that while it might engage or entertain, you know, readers of different kinds and from different, you know, walks of life, that it'll open up various doors of inquiry that will prompt them to think, or, you know, with images that linger in their mind, etc. So, you know, I'm trying to achieve that sort of artistic complexity that that can attract a closer reading, and if that's a PhD student, that's terrific. If it's someone like you, that's great too.
Well, you have created a modern masterpiece. That's my opinion, and the opinion of, I think, everyone who has read this book. Now, just for those listeners of mine who might not have heard about it, but I've talked about it so many times that I know that most of them have. This is a fantastic, the concept is brilliant. It is about Count Alexander Rostov, who as a young man is declared a non-person by the communist authorities. And he's exiled to the Grand Metropole Hotel in Moscow. And of course, this is a punishment in many ways, because of he is now forced to live in the shadows of the type of lifestyle that he was accustomed to. So this is considered a punishment. And it's what, of course, Count Rostov makes of it. And he makes something of it.
Exactly.
And you know, it is a book. It's a complex book. It's a long book. And it, as everybody I've spoken to who have read it, always, it's not quite long enough. I know that for myself, when I got near the end, I stopped reading it. And I said, I can't. I don't want it to end. And then eventually I did. And I was very satisfied, very happy with the ending, which is always, you know, a wonderful thing. So when, you know, now that you are out there with this book and you're getting so many compliments, I'm sure that it's rather thrilling for you that you've had this reception of your book.
Yeah, I mean certainly you know you put in the time and effort to make a book, and you want it to reach its audience ultimately. So having the book find its way into an audience is very satisfying for an author, without question. I mean, it beats, you know, obscurity or the book ending up in a cave in silence. But you know, because of course that's what the effort is about, is you're trying to create something which will engage people and prompt conversation and give them some satisfaction. If it reaches nobody, then to some degree, it's, you know, the book has not achieved its end.
Well, you certainly have achieved. You've achieved a lot here, not just because the writing is so very good, elegant and sophisticated and erudite, but it's so reachable. It's a type of book that anybody can read this book and they will find something in this book, whether it the Count's nature, he has this wonderful personality where hasn't given up and doesn't give up throughout the book. And this is wonderful. And then, of course, you weave all of these wonderful characters within the book, which are so, you know, this is so important, this, like, the triumvirate of friends that just are beautifully drawn. From one character to another, you have done a fantastic job.
Thanks. I mean, I do as an art form. The novel has many different elements to it. You know, whether it's the plot or the tone or the points of view, the symbolism that incorporates dialogue. There's, and I could go on. But certainly, one of the most essential elements of the novel that distinguishes it from other forms of art, whether it's music or painting, is that it is or poetry. It is a place where characters can be created in a three-dimensional fashion. You know, if the work is well done, we, in engaging with a novel, can feel like we've actually met someone. We can see what they're doing. We can empathize with or anticipate what they're going to feel about a certain situation. We can sort of follow their train of thought. We really can connect with other parties. And this kind of goes back to the beginnings of English narrative, you know, which with Shakespeare kind of begins right with a peak. That's, of course, the Shakespearean mission. His plays are, whether they're comedies, histories, tragedies, he's creating a setting that may be pretty simple in the grand scheme of things, but within that setting, he's placing a variety of characters which he's going to realize in a fully three-dimensional form with all of their, you know, their whims, their contradictions, their impulses, their sentiments, their memories. He's going to get them to interact around some series of events, but through that, through the way in which those three-dimensional figures interact and how they respond to events, how they respond to each other, how they share their feelings, their thoughts, we as readers or as observers in a theater ideally make some, it's the human condition that we're connect at the end of the day, that through that interaction we can begin in our own minds to explore what it means to be human. And I mean, that's, as I say, you know, the play, the novel really provide that, as it's one of the central advantages the novel has, is that you can bring these individuals, when you're successful, to life, allow them to interact, we can feel that we're present in the room, and then we can begin to grapple with the human condition and ideally see ideas, you know, that are universal to some degree, that are timeless. You know, that we're taking this moment in time, whether it's Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet, this brief moment where we're going to see these people interact over a brief period of time, but through their interactions, we're going to ideally have insights that are timeless and universal at the same time.
Well, it's amazing, you know, and here we are in the 21st century, and the story of Count Rostov, who was born in the 19th century, captures our imagination. And one of the things, of course, now we're so involved with Russia, it's on our minds all the time. It's in the news constantly. And I think this book really serves a great purpose in getting people to think about Russia and to think about the times and what it meant for the revolution and when the communists took over. And this idea of creating a non-person, that someone, that a totalitarian government can come in and say, well, this person actually doesn't exist anymore. We're just going to, you know, put him in this kind of limbo, whether it was in, of course, in the Count's case, he was lucky it was in the metropole, and so many others, and really millions, landed up in Siberia. So it does open our eyes to this idea of what the revolution meant to Russia.
Sure, it's using that as a context to look at human events, and I think that an aspect of the book for me, it's not the principal one, but an important one is tied to my feeling and my feeling that the American view of Russia in my youth was far too narrow, particularly its view of the period between the revolution and the end of the Cold War. We were basically raised to be very conscious of the fact that era in Russia was defined by shortages, bread lines, fear of arrest, possibility of execution, political and artistic oppression. And certainly these were elements of the Stalinist era. There's no question about that. But almost for political reasons, in the height of the Cold War, we Americans of my generation were raised to think, that's it. That's all. That's the only experience there was in Russia during all those decades. But of course, that's not true. During those decades, Russians continued to fall in love, to have children, to want the best for their children, to engage with art, to listen to classical works of music and to be moved by them, to read classical works of literature from a different perspective than ours, but with much of the same outcome in terms of how it affected them, to celebrate anniversaries, holidays, all these things that are part of the fabric of life, anywhere, were there in Russia at the same time. And so during those turbulent decades. And so the book, to some degree, is an exploration of that, of at least rebalancing, or looking at a set of experiences where the shadow of what was dangerous and unhappy about those decades is passing over the hotel, it's passing over Moscow, it's influencing various characters to a lesser or greater degree, but at the same time, the basic human interactions are taking place. People will, I think of it as the will to joy, that people will pursue, even in eras of hardship or shortages, will find some means of making connections with each other, of celebrating with their families, of taking whatever humble elements they have and gathering around the table anyway, much as the Americans did during the Depression. We're in a period where you had extreme shortages, people under great duress, and yet continuing to pursue their lives and as best they could. And so the book is, to some degree, as I say, an examination of how those two things occur in simultaneously.
Well, you have developed Count Rostov so beautifully. When one reads Tolstoy, one never sort of thinks about what Tolstoy was like as a person. One doesn't sort of imagine him thinking of himself as a Vronsky or acting like a Vronsky. And yet, when I couldn't help, when I'm reading your book, just hoping that part of you is very much like the Count. Well, of course, you have to have, I think, that there's a sort of a devilish humor in this book, a wit, and I think, that can only come from the fact that it has to be part of, I think, your personality, too.
Well, you're nice. I think my wife would like it if I was more like Count Rostov. I'm not sure. I certainly wouldn't claim to match him in most respects. But this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, was Shakespeare... I'm not trying to compare myself to Shakespeare, but was Shakespeare more like Macbeth? Was he more like Hamlet? Was he more like Romeo? Which was he? Was he King Lear? Or which character in Hamlet was he? And over the years, people have said, oh, he's, the Hamlet is Shakespeare. But it is, of course, he's all of these people. And it is the mastery of inhabiting other personalities, other personality types, other backgrounds, and imagining their lives, connecting their lives, empathizing their lives, that is, is the spark at the heart of the Shakespeare's great art and its longevity. Is because he can do it. He's none of those people yet. He is all of them to some degree. And I think that it should be the mission of someone who's doing serious narrative work. There are writers who their main goal is to in essence translate their own personal experience for your consumption, and at its height that can have the grandeur and the scope of Shakespeare, but it can also be a rather limited form if that author doesn't sort of get out of their own mindset and try to inhabit the lives of others. But as I say, I do think the history of narrative is really more about this idea of creating different personality types, and the author being a vehicle for that. I don't. It's not magic involved in the creation of narrative, but it is interesting, I think, for me as an artist, that the if I'm making a character well, if I've thought through the character well, I understand their history, I understand their personality. It's not my history, it's not my personality. I will learn from that character to some degree. That you know, there are some readers will point to a sentence in Rules of Civility or in Gentleman in Moscow that they find particularly insightful. Say, oh, this sentence, et cetera. Often those sentences that they like or that resonate with them or that were insightful are ones that I never would have come up with on my own in my day-to-day life. I would not have said them to my children or to my spouse or considered them myself. They are the product of living for a moment in the character's shoes. You know, it is the character with his or her background, which I don't have, put in a circumstance which I have not been in, that prompts that character with that personality, that background, under those situations, to make that observation.
And well, that's,
as I'm writing, you feel that. You're like, oh, the person, the kind of in essence, the character says, oh, comes up with this sort of insight of the moment, and it catches me by surprise to some degree. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's true. Wow, yeah, that's a good point. Okay. But I wouldn't have that experience if I wasn't inhabiting that other personality for a moment.
Well, I just want to say that Count Alexander Rostov is, I'm sure, I know he is one of my favorite characters now in literature, and he will be, I think, forever a favorite character of millions of readers. And I want to bring more readers to you, because I think this book is important. I think as a sample of what a reader should of what a writer should attain. Of course, I think you're writing partly. The brilliance of it is that you are yourself well read, and you've drawn upon so much of your knowledge of writers and of good reading to develop this character, which is going to be a beloved character forever, I think. And I want to, one of the things that I found very important is I want readers to really approach this book with a open heart and just flow with it. And that's, I want them to go to your website. I think your website is fantastic because you have a lot of background there. So what's your website is just amortolls.com.
That's right. Just myname.com, amortolls.com.
And they can read some of the background after they read the book. They can go to this and just be filled up with more information, because, as I said, once you read this book, you don't want to put it down. And it is a book that all of us who have read it once are reading it twice. Now, I have on the phone, and I'm going to be talking to him in a few minutes, the narrator of the book.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's important. I want my readers, one, to know that when they finish the book, the third time or the fourth time, go to the narrated version, the audible version.
The audiobook, yeah.
Well, the audiobook has been done brilliantly. I'm sure you're very proud of that, what he did with it.
Yes, I think he's done a terrific job. And it's, listeners will come to that conclusion on their own, I think.
Exactly. I don't always, get crazy about an audible version of a book, because I'm, a purist, and the book and the written word is important to me. But in this case, your words translate so beautifully to an audible book. As one reading your book, one hears them in your head anyway, and they stay with you. And so that Nick has done this fantastic audible version is amazing. And so I'm going to be talking to him now, but I will keep telling people about your book. And I want to thank you so much for coming on. As I said, I don't want to sort of give away what's going to happen. I was surprised.
Right.
One step at a time. All you have to do, and I'm telling all my listeners, all they have to do is read the first page and they can't stop.
You're overly generous. I would warn your readers who haven't read the book that the first 100 pages are slower than the. But if you make it through if you enjoy the first hundred pages, you're going to love the next 300 pages. There's a certain investment in getting to know the character and the environment that he's in.
The wonderful thing about it being slow is that it calms you down, and I think that's
okay.
That in this day and age when everybody is so nervous about everything, that is probably one of the best points of the book. I'm calm when I read that book, and I'm happy, and I'm thrilled, to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you, too. And thank you again for all of your support, Patsy. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, and I'm going to go talk to Nick now. And
please give him my best.
I will. Okay, so I'm going straight to Nick. Bye. Okay. Hey. Hi, Nick.
Yes, I was just listening, and wonderful.
Wow. Isn't the book. He is amazing, and I just have to introduce you. You are Nicholas Guy Smith, and you are called That Voice. And you are that voice, you know, and I have a feeling that so many, particularly so many women who love this book and have now found, you know, I read the book three times before I got to the Audible version. And I already had in my head what the voice should sound like. And as I approached the Audible version, I was prepared to turn it off after the first 2 minutes. Because I knew if the voice was wrong, if it wasn't the voice in my head, it would ruin the book. So I was really quite nervous because I'm not, you know, being a book lover and somebody who's like, I've read 10,000 books. I'm a person of words and I'm a person, you know, with on a page. So
absolutely. I mean, if the narrator's voice is a little scratchy or whining, you can certainly turn off the listener.
And then, like the piece de resistance was then I looked at your picture and I thought, oh my gosh. My gosh, not only do I have this beautiful voice to listen to, I have this beautiful face to look at. Wow.
Very sweet. I was very fortunate to have this book. I'm fortunate also to have a brilliant director at Penguin Random House, Linda Korn, who was always there providing interesting feedback and helping both of us to make very creative choices. But the book itself, the characters, I mean, that's what really made the whole experience so enjoyable. It's so well written.
Every word. I'm being somebody who reads a lot of books, and especially, you know, I've read every Russian book you can imagine. And I was reading Tolstoy, you know, when I was 12 years old. So when I came to this book and I saw the level of writing and the brilliance of it, and the use of words and the use of language, it was so amazing. And, well, I can imagine from a narrator's point of view, what a joy it was to do this.
It was very, very, every morning I would come in to the studio, and it was a sheer pleasure just to meet an old friend. For me, the Count is like Zorba the Greek. He's in love with life, and so when I was trying to cast his voice, I was thinking to myself, who could play this role? And I just went through all these different British actors and came up with Sir Ralph Richardson. I don't know if you're familiar with
him. Oh, yes.
He has that, I don't know, you know, that lovely, elegant, beautiful sort of English voice. That's where the voice came from, and that's how I developed it. But it was a joy, you know, really wonderful to come in and to meet the Count and to see him going through all these different experiences in this hotel for 30 years, you know?
And with such spirit, with wow, yeah, and all of the parts where he writes, I can't decide which section I like the most. I, for example, as I was mentioning to Amor, for those of us who have read the book and who love the book, we no longer call it A Gentleman in Moscow. We call it the book. We say, do you remember the part in the book about the bees? Do you remember the part about, you know, the saffron? Everything is just so perfect in this book.
Yeah.
Did you have certain sections that you really, really loved?
I like the sections with the bishop, who's quite an evil character of sorts. The business with the actress when she throws her clothes out the window, I remember that. The 50-year-old count with a 5-year-old girl. There's so many precious moments in the book.
Even the opening, I really enjoyed that. Not the court scene, but the one after.
Is there one scene that you would like to read for us that we could set up?
Yes. Yes, and I don't know, because I didn't hear the rest of the interview. I want to know whether or not Walter actually read the sentences out loud after he wrote them, because when you read it aloud, it's almost like poetry in places. But I have a section. It's a couple of pages. Is that okay?
Yes, we have time. And I can listen to your voice for 17 hours or 700 hours.
Well, this section, I'm not going to give it away to the listeners, but what's happening, but basically he's in an office, and the office belongs to the bishop, who is somewhat in control of the hotel. And that's all I'm going to say. Okay, here we go. Headwaiter Rostov, he said almost peevishly, you have no business being in this office. I insist that you leave immediately. The Count raised one of the pistols. Sit down. How dare you? Sit down, the Count repeated more slowly. The bishop would be the first to admit that he had no experience with firearms. In fact, he could barely distinguish between a revolver and a semi-automatic. But any fool could see that what the Count was holding was an antique, a museum piece, a curiosity. You leave me no choice but to alert the authorities, he said. Then, stepping forward, he took up the receiver from one of his two telephones. The Count shifted his aim from the bishop to the portrait of Stalin and shot the former premier between the eyes. Shocked by either the sound or the sacrilege, the bishop jumped back, dropping the receiver with a clatter. The Count raised the second pistol and leveled it at the bishop's chest. Sit down, he said again. This time, the bishop obliged. With the second still trained on the bishop's chest, the Count now stood. He replaced the telephone receiver in its cradle. He backed around the bishop's chair and locked the office door. Then he returned to his seat behind the desk. The two men were quiet as the bishop restored his sense of superiority. Well, head waiter Rostov, it seems that by threat of violence you have succeeded in keeping me against my will. What do you intend to do now? We're going to wait.
Wait for what? The Count didn't answer. After a few moments, one of the telephones began to ring. Instinctively, the bishop reached for it, but the Count shook his head. It rang 11 times before it went silent. How long do you expect to hold me here? Insisted the bishop. An hour? Two? Until morning? It was a good question. The Count looked around the walls of the room for a clock, but couldn't find one. Give me your watch, he said. Excuse me? You heard me. The bishop removed the watch from his wrist and tossed it on the desk. Generally speaking, the Count was not in favor of relieving men of their possessions at gunpoint, but having prided himself on ignoring the second hand for so many years, the time had come for the Count to attend to it. According to the bishop's watch, which was probably set 5 minutes far to ensure that he was never late for work, it was almost 1 a.m. There would still be a few of the hotel's guests returning from late suppers, a few stragglers in the bar, the clearing and setting up of the piazza, the vacuuming of the lobby. But by 2:30, the hotel would be quiet in every corner. Make yourself comfortable, said the Count. Then, to pass the time, he began to whistle a bit of Mozart from Così fan tutte. Somewhere in the second movement, he became conscious of the fact that the bishop was smiling dismissively. Is there something on your mind? Asked the Count. The left upper corner of the bishop's mouth twitched. Your sort, he sneered. how convinced you have always been of the rightness of your actions, as if God himself was so impressed with your precious manners and delightful way of putting things that he blessed you to do as you pleased. What vanity!
The bishop let out what must have passed in his household for a laugh.
Well, you have had your time, he continued. You have had your chance to dance with your illusions and act with impunity. But your little orchestra has stopped playing. Whatever you say or do now, whatever you think, even if it is at 2 or 3 in the morning behind a locked door, will come to light. And when it does, you will be held to account.
The count listened to the bishop with more interest and a touch of surprise. His thought, the Lord's blessing that he could do as he pleased, while dancing with his illusions. The count had no idea what the bishop was talking about. After all, he had now lived under house arrest in the Metropole Hotel for over half his life. He almost smiled, on the verge of making some quip about the large imaginations of small men, but his expression instead grew sober as he considered the bishop's smug assurance that all would come to light. His gaze shifted to the filing cabinets, of which there were now 5. With the barrel of the pistol still trained on the bishop, the count crossed to the filing cabinets and pulled at the left uppermost drawer. It was locked.
Where is the key? You have no business opening those cabinets. They contain my personal files.
The count went around to the back of the desk and opened the drawers. They were surprisingly empty. Where would a man like the bishop keep the key to his personal files?
Why? On his person, of course.
The count came around the desk and stood over the bishop.
You can give me that key, he said, or I can take it from you. But there is no third way.
When the bishop looked up with an expression of mild indignation, he saw that the count had raised the old pistol in the air with a clear intention of bringing it down across his face. The bishop took a small ring of keys from a pocket and threw it on the desk. Even as they landed in a jangle, the count could see that the bishop had undergone something of a transformation. He had suddenly lost his sense of superiority, as if all along it had been secured by his possession of these keys. Picking up the ring, the count sorted through them until he found the smallest. Then he unlocked all of the bishop's filing cabinets, one by one.
I want to thank you so much, Nick. Your reading is so fantastic and so enthralling. And I must tell you that I have discovered that if I play this, you know, I play the Audible for people, they run out and not only buy the Audible, they buy the book because they are just so enthralled with your reading. And you have really captured, and I know that Amor Tolles is so happy with your reading. You have captured the essence of Count Rostov, and it's just a joy to listen to you.
Well, thank you for your kind words. That's great. And it's a wonderful experience for me recording. It's great to feel that, you know, somebody like that will have a bit of joy from Count Rostov. I'm very happy.
Well, it is such a wonderful book. And, you know, Amor has developed a character here that I think will live on forever. And once people read the book and hear your voice, it's something that sticks in their minds forever. And you've done a beautiful job. It's been an absolute joy listening to you. I listen to you. I've listened to it. I think 3-4 times. I know. Wow. I have a neighbor who every night. I mean, literally every night she goes to sleep. She puts it on the 30-minute timer and she goes to sleep listening to your voice.
Taught my mother that, and she was laughing. I told her that story.
No, yeah, but it's wonderful. It's just the book is so calming, and then your voice is so absolutely mellifluous and lovely. So I know that you're giving a lot of joy to many people. I'm buying the Audible version to give to elders that I know who I know will really appreciate it. So Again, thank you, Nicholas Guy Smith.
I look forward to the next time you interview me on another audio book. We shall see.
I will be happy to. Okay? So you are definitely that voice, and just thank you so much.
I can't wait to listen to the interview.
Thanks again.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, Patsy.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Oh, I enjoy talking to him. I've talked to him a couple more times over the past few years, and he is always a joy. Now, it's ran a little long, so we're going to do some commercials, and then when I come back, I have a few things to announce. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I only have a few minutes, but I want to go over some of the guests that are coming up. Next week, I have Sherry Harris. She's the absolutely fantastic writer of the Sarah Winston Garage Sale Mysteries. I love those books. Every time I go to a garage sale, I peek around the corner. I look under tables just to see if I'm going to find a body. You never know. It's the way that Sherry writes, she always makes a garage sale so exciting. So I'm thrilled that she's going to be on the program on Tuesday. And then on January 7th, I have returning to the program, Andrew Grant and his wife, Tasha Alexander. They are two of my favorite authors. They were on my 4th anniversary program. And so I'm so thrilled that they're coming back and we're going to be talking about their... It's so nice. Their books were released on the same date, so it turned out just perfectly. I could have them both on to talk about their books. And then something really exciting. This is my absolute favorite actress is Audrey Hepburn. I love Audrey Hepburn. And there's a new book about her called Dutch Girl, Audrey Hepburn and World War II. And the author is Robert Mattson. It's wonderful that I'm going to have him on, but even more exciting is that I'm going to have Audrey Hepburn's son on the program so that I can... This is just such a thrill for me because, as I said, I've always loved Audrey Hepburn. When I was little, I wanted to look like Audrey Hepburn, which is a little funny for a girl from the Upper Peninsula, and with blonde hair and blue eyes, but this, she was my ideal. And I just love her movies, and I've always really admired her and all that she went through during World War II. So her story is fascinating, and I'm so looking forward to talking to her son. And his name is Luca Dotti, and he wrote a book about his mom before. Now, this book, it takes a little bit different angle. It talks a lot about, he talked about his mom as a mom. And this new book is talking about, really, what a courageous, courageous woman Audrey Hepburn was as a young girl, taking chances to save people. So the whole, the entire book is just, it's a nail biter. And I'm so thrilled that they're going to be on. And I also have, I have so many. I have two or three more Mystery Writer of America Grandmasters coming up in January and February, including Bill Pranzini and his wife, Marsha Muller. They're going to be back on. They were on a few years ago. And it was so much, it was so funny when I went to BouchaCon in Dallas. Now, they had been on the program a few years ago, and I've been waiting to have them back. And there I'm sitting at a table, luncheon table, and right there in the centerpiece, the books that they had were their, both of their books. And so it was really nice and wonderful reminder. As soon as I got back from BouchaCon, I contacted them and invited them to come back to talk. They're a wonderful husband and wife writing team. And so this is, you know, I love it. I love the dynamics, for example, with both Bill Pranzini and Marsha Muller, and then Andrew Grant and his wife, Tasha Alexander. You know, they are couples who are writing teams, and they have a special dynamic, because when you have two writers in the family, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of excitement and in their lives, and so I'm so thrilled that both of them are going to be on. And then I want to tell you something really amazing, and this is fantastic. Ken Follett has a new book coming out. It's a prequel to The Pillars of the Earth. If you haven't read The Pillars of the Earth yet, you should do it, because he is an absolutely wonderful author. But and now the new book is a prequel, and it's going to concentrate on those years around the year 1000 when the Vikings were attacking England. And it's going to be an absolutely exciting book. And of course, you know, The Pillars of the Earth sold almost 30 million books. I think he sold over at least 150 million books, if not more. And I'm sure this new book will be a great success. And so it's really exciting that he's going to be he's also going to be on the program once the book comes out. The nice thing, I know his agent, and so I will be able to get him on, which is nice, because he's really a big, big, important author. Now, that deal was announced in Publishers Weekly. I have told all of you, if you are looking for an agent, you know, sometimes you want to be an indie author, and there's lots of advantages to being an indie author, publishing yourself. In some cases, you keep a higher percentage of your money. But also, if you have an agent, and if you're looking for an agent, you should go to Publishers Weekly. They have a section there under business, and it's the deal of the week. And it's every week. So 52 weeks a year, you can find at least three, maybe four agents who are active. These are the agents you want. They got big deals. I mean, yeah. Ken Follett got a seven-figure deal. And then a lesser-known author, you know, it's you never know. You never know what's going to happen. Although, you know, these things can happen. It's just so exciting when an author gets a seven-figure deal. And another author who just got one is Michael Harriet. And he is... Well, he walked away with a seven-figure deal. I'm going to try to get him on, too. So this is always fun. I love to hear how excited they get. I would get excited, too, if I had a seven-figure deal. But it's just wonderful. And so just go to Publishers Weekly, and you will see there a list of active agents, agents who know how to get a deal for you. And so that's what I recommend. That's what I recommend. Never buy those ABC books, and never search the internet for a list of agents, because half of those are already out of the business by the time they are listed, and you only want the ones who are getting big deals right now. And that's the only way to find them. Of course, for all of you out there, whether you have an agent or you're publishing on your own, remember, you have to do so much today. You have to wear so many hats and develop so many talents. And it was wonderful. I had Elliot Smith here last week, and he was talking about so many of the things that you have to do in order to be successful. And I will have his interview up on my webpage today. I also want to thank, again, Glenn L. Erickson. His book, he was here last week, and we talked about his new book called Android Love. And when my sister-in-law was here, she said, you know, what books should I take back? Well, I always give her books. And I said, she said, well, what books do you think I'd enjoy? She didn't want, you know, a very long book. Because they stop along the way in hotels. And so she wants a book that, you know, she can read while she's in the hotel. And I said, here is a wonderful book, and it's called Android Love. It's a love story. It's a speculative, not sci-fi exactly. It's just something, what could happen if an android could come to life. And so it's fascinating. And Glenn L. Erickson has done a great job with that book. And one of the things I like about it, I like the characters. You know, this is a book, when it's character-driven, keeps you interested. And I particularly like, what would happen to just an ordinary person? That's always a question. You know, so often it's, you know, books are about somebody tough and big and famous or strong or whatever. But what happens to just an ordinary guy, a truck driver? He's just a truck driver. What happens when he's put in a situation? Is he able to rise to the occasion? Is he able to do something good? Does he learn along the way? And so that's what I really like about Glenn L. Erickson's book. It's available on Amazon, and you can go there and get it. It's a quick read, and at the end, you'll be thinking about it. The android's name is Marie, and you'll be thinking about Richard and Marie for a long time after you finish that book, because it really is fascinating. And that's what you want. That's what you want in a book. You want a book that grabs you, a book that is very visual, and you can see it in your mind as you're reading it. And that's what you'll get with Android Love. So I hope that you will check that out. It's on Amazon, and it's his first book on Amazon. So it's very exciting for him. And just get the book and enjoy it. And what else? Oh, well, go to my website, radio-joyonpaper. I'm adding more and more content, and by January, I'm going to have tons of content about things that you, as a writer, need to know, all of the different sort of hats that you're wearing, whether it's marketing, promotion, speaking to the public, all sorts of stuff like that. So keep in mind to go to my webpage over the next month or so and find out. But meanwhile, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very lucky, to hear those absolutely magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't unless you get to work. Start writing. In a year, you're going to have one big fat book, 365 pages. Just think of it. That's exciting. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Thanks for everything you do. And he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye, everybody.